Previously on Beta.
So you're a magician?
Sure. Only after Jesus returns to Earth following his ascension to heaven can Earth then itself be destroyed.
But this is going to be like strumming styles of punk and alternative music from 1970 to 2000.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta. Today, Ling Ma joins us to talk about her debut short story collection, Bliss Montage. These are eerie, surreal stories that explore alienation, immigration, and relationships.
I was thinking about these archetypes of masculinity, but I thought, what if you push that even further to the extreme? Like, what does hysterical masculinity look like?
Also, writer Jim Ruland on the rise and fall of SST Records, the iconic indie label that introduced us to bands like Black Flag, The Minutemen, and Sonic Youth.
Husker Du were huge, and the way they toured and traveled the country was extremely influential and was exactly what SST was looking for in artists.
But first,
the corners of these dice cut into your palms a little. They didn't lay easy in your hand. These dice were fair and honest. These dice were cold and objective. These dice had no mercy. These dice had destroyed lives. This pair of dice was now God. They were Bobby's masters. They felt good in his pocket.
I'm sure you recognize that voice. That's Penn Jillette. Chances are you know Penn as one half of the Masters of Magic, Penn and Teller. Their innovative illusions have captivated audiences around the world, and their live show is the longest-running show in Las Vegas. But there's much more to Penn than the bullet catch trick. He's also a writer. Penn has published several books, including the New York Times bestseller, God, No! Signs You Already May Be an Atheist, and other magical tales. Penn's latest book is a novel called Random. It's a funny, suspenseful story about Las Vegas native Bobby Ingersoll. A few weeks before his 21st birthday, Bobby learns that he has inherited a large gambling debt from his father. After he pays off the debt, he takes a whole new approach to his life. Bobby chooses to let the rolls of his lucky dice make all of his life decisions for him. Penn joined us from his Sin City home to talk about Random and how he came up with the idea.
We were doing a television program in England, and someone that we were working with, I got to know her a bit. And one day, very oddly, she called me into a room alone, and she asked me if I'd read this book called The Dice Man, and I said no. She said, well, would you read it for me? So we had a few days off, so I picked up the book, and I read it, and I came back, and she called me in to talk to her again privately and said, what'd you think of the book? And I said, well, it's silly. It's a, you know, it's essentially a satire of Est written in the 70s with a guy who comes up with this self-help theory of rolling dice for your decisions. And I said, you know, I didn't really like the book very much. I didn't like the comedic style of it. I don't really care for satire hardly ever. I like things sincere, but boy, that dice thing is pretty compelling. I said, I wonder if people live like that, because I read a few things that said that they had. She then opened a briefcase, because this was the early 90s. She opened a briefcase and pulled out these two gorgeous dice, kind of golden, at least golden color, and bejeweled. And said, I do this. And then I said to her, you took this job because of the dice. And she said, oh, yes. And I said, and are you, in any decisions that you're making on our TV show, are you using the dice? She said, only when I'm not sure.
Wow.
And so I just ran this story over and over in my head. And I pitched it to many people as a TV show, even sold it once. And then that deal fell apart because, you know, show business. And I told all my friends about it. And I will tell you, I will kind of answer the question before you ask it. I've never done it myself. I am such a all or nothing personality that I believe it would be too dangerous for me. I had two friends, perhaps interestingly, women, both of them, who I told them about. And they went through, both of them went through a tough time after that and called me up and said, I'm just going to do dice for a while. And I went, well, I don't think you should. Tell me everything about it. And yeah. They had amazing experiences. They really mm-hmm. did.
Was there a temptation at all to use the dice to make decisions the way Bobby does when you write? Because when you're writing a novel, you have to make a ton of decisions.
Oh, well, I want to say yes, but the answer is really no. I rolled the dice so that all the roles that you see in the story are roles that I actually made. And then I engineered the decisions and so on to fit the arc of the story I wanted to do.
Yeah, and you did it very well. I couldn't help, while I was reading Random, I couldn't help thinking of Philip K. Dick's book, The Man in the High Castle. You're familiar with it probably, and how he used the ancient Chinese text, the I Ching, to make decisions while he was developing the themes, the plot, and the story. And obviously that's not something you consider doing with Random, because if you were to do that, you would have done it with dice.
And also, you know, you have all the William Burroughs and all the beat poets who experimented with that. And certainly the Life in the Bush of Ghosts with Brian Eno and David Byrne. They did a lot of choices random. And also, and I've talked to David a little bit, he was also using veto power. Which, strangely enough, and I guess this is maybe where I cross over into me being insane part of the interview. I think with art, you want to use the veto power, but if you're doing it in life, you cannot give yourself that option. I mean, that might be backwards what many people would think, but for me, the people I talk to that live dice life, the important thing is when those dice hit, it instantly tells you what you're going to do. And what I also found fascinating as I wrote it and thought about it and felt it was how deeply programmed we are for religion. You may know that I'm a rather public atheist, but I'm fascinated by habit and by ritual. I mean, maybe one of the reasons I'm such a strong atheist is because all my leanings go toward religion. I really like to follow rules. I really like to follow patterns. I really like rituals. And it's very hard to knock me out of that. And that's one of the things writing this book that I found so seductive about that on both sides. Because on the side of doing what the dice say, you have this complete submission to, if you will, I'm using this obviously eccentrically, but to a higher power. It is about it being random and there being no destiny and there being no power, but acting as though there is. And that is to me the whole book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Very well said. You mentioned earlier that you like structure and order and everything. So I wonder, though, do you ever consider or think about the idea of living a more random lifestyle?
I have. I really have. And this whole book is me considering that and thinking about it. One of the important things about Bobby is although he has and feels huge responsibilities to his family and to people that he loves, I've set it up so he has no responsibilities that are time dependent. The two women that I know that lived dice life for a few months, besides having the greatest sex stories ever, they also both had stories of not showing up for their job. One of them, who was in biotech, actually, she rolled the dice one Monday morning, did not go to work, and flew to the Caribbean. It took 4 days. And when she got back, she was sure she'd be fired. And in a very nutty thing, her boss said to her, you know, I know you took 4 days and just went away, and I think it's because you work so hard and we don't appreciate you enough, so we're going to give you a little bit of a raise and a better job.
So it paid off well for her, yeah.
Yeah, but that shocked her. But for me, I am so aware that I made promises to tell her and promises to my family and promises to my coworkers that I couldn't live Dice life in good faith and also keep my responsibilities in good faith. And I go through some serious acrobatics to make sure that Bobby can live Dice life and still be moral.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You do definitely do that. It's interesting. You mentioned a while back earlier in our talk that you pitched Random to Hollywood. You pitched it as a TV show with this theme, and one network kind of sort of bought one version. But as you say in the end of the book, there's nothing more random than Hollywood. But you're a magician and a cultural phenomenon. You can't just make it happen, can you?
No,
because it really should be a series.
Well, you know, now that the book's out, strangely enough, some of the same people that forgot that I talked to them about this
uh-huh.
have come to me and said, wow, this could be interesting. And I go, okay. Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm really interested in a TV series that would be open-ended, because as I finish the book, I'm really, really interested in what Bobby does with the next 10 years of his life, because he will continue to live random, I believe. And I want to see what happens. And I don't think I'm going to write a sequel. So I want someone else to do that. And if you get a TV show, you get really brilliant showrunners. I'm not really a teller. I am not a television writer. And I would love
not
to
yet.
See. I would love to see what someone. I would love to see what someone with those skills would do with this.
I couldn't help but think about the Martin Mull song, I Haven't the Vaguest Idea. And in the song, he calls it the craziest dot on the map. You've lived in Las Vegas for what? I think 28 years, 29 years now?
Yeah.
How did Las Vegas serve as a creative muse to Random? Or did it? It must have.
I don't think I would have written it at all the same way in New York. I mean, I believe that if I had the idea for Random, I would have thought that setting it in Las Vegas was much too on the nose if I didn't really know Las Vegas. I think I would be offended if a person had that idea and set it in Vegas and didn't live in Vegas for a long time. Because I think if you were a tourist to Vegas and you were writing this book, you would set it on the Strip and in the casinos. I wrote a lot of the first part of the book sitting in the Starbucks on Fremont Street with the kiss impersonators and the people who get kicked in the nuts for money and the magicians all working on Fremont Street. And every time outsiders show Vegas, they show, you know, the MGM Grand, and they show the Bellagio, and they show that. But Fremont Street has this kind of a combination of a county fair and a meth lab that just walks up and down the street, and it's street performers, and it's a level of weird chance that doesn't happen on the Strip. So I think that if I hadn't discovered that there's a world of Las Vegas that's not the Strip, I would have considered it too on the nose, but I hope that people reading this will see that the Vegas that I show is perhaps a little different than the Vegas they've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very well said. Some of those Fremont scenes are among my favorite parts of the book, although everything in the book is great. Do you see a connection between writing novels and performing magic? Do they have something in common?
The funny thing is that my first goal in life was to be a writer, not to be a performer. That's what I really wanted. And I just found, I mean, this is such a strange thing to say, but I found that I had a certain kind of ability in performing that people reacted to, and I really, really liked it. So, you know, my sister, who I was very, very close to and who was much, much older than me. She was 23 years older than me. So she saw me in almost an aunt or even a grandmother position growing up, and, of course, saw Broadway and saw all the shows leading up to Broadway and saw my juggling shows and talent shows when I was a child, would always say to me, you never seem more satisfied and more yourself than after you finish writing something or when you're playing bass behind someone else and not in the lead. And she said, that's always where you seem to me the most natural in the pen that I know. Had I not met Teller and started, you know, the most interesting conversation of my life, had I not met Teller, the chances of me having gone into magic were zero. I didn't even care for magic. So the conversation with Teller is kind of all that magic is to me. Everyone else in magic, and I think I can say that almost that globally, everyone else in magic got obsessed with the magic side of magic at the age of like 11 or 12. I hated that. I did not like it. I did not like magic. I did not like the make-believe of magic. I did not like the lying of magic. And it was only when Teller told me that magic was essentially intellectual, more than the other art forms. Music hits your body, poetry hits your body, comedy hits your body, but magic really hits your mind. Those other things do as well, but magic leads with that. Magic leads with it only exists if you know what's impossible. That's not true for music. So that's what interests me in magic. And what interests me also in magic is the ability to tell the truth while lying. And in magic, of course, that is not the subtext, that's the text. But in novels especially, writing is really that. The entire thing is a lie. The entire thing didn't happen. And yet you are drilling down deeper than you can in essays to what the truth is as you see it, you know? And in that way, the telling a lie to get to the truth, and I'm using truth here very, very broadly to mean what I believe in my heart and not any sort of objective truth. So please allow me that odd definition for that.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. And that's great. You started out wanting to be a writer and then you became a performer, but you're still a writer. And thank God that you met up with Teller and you had that conversation with him.
Yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't say thank God. Sorry about the thank God.
You could say thank random chance and you'd be exactly
thank random
right.
chance. That's yeah. For that conversation. And thank you for writing my material for me, Penn. It's much better than what I come up with. Penn Jillette, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank
you. Such a pleasure to talk to you and congratulations on Random.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
Penn Jillette is the author of the novel Random. He's also one half of the magicians extraordinaire and kings of Sin City, Penn and Teller. You don't have to roll a lucky 7 to find out more about Penn and Random. Just head over to wpr.org/beta.
If there's any unifying theme through the stories, often it's the relationships between family members and friends and ex-boyfriends.
Coming up, Ling Ma on her hallucinatory, surreal short story collection, Bliss Montage. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're looking for hallucinatory, haunting tales, you don't need to look any further than Ling Ma's debut short story collection, Bliss Montage. Ling's book features spellbinding stories about a woman who lives with 100 of her ex-boyfriends and a professor who has a portal in the closet of his office. There's also a story about a drug called G that makes you invisible but has some dangerous side effects. Ling has also proven her predictive powers with her award-winning 2018 novel, Severance. The book's storyline about the Shen fever pandemic sweeping across the world seemed to predict the coronavirus outbreak. Whether she predicted it or not, Ling had to deal with the fallout of COVID isolation. She spent that time writing the surreal short stories that make up Bliss Montage.
I guess many of the stories were written mostly within the first year of the pandemic, so when we were undergoing lockdown, and so it was a very solitary time. And I guess what came back to me were relationships, I suppose, if there's any unifying theme through the stories. Often it's the relationships between family members and friends and ex-boyfriends. Many of the stories deal with that.
Mm-hmm. You describe your subconscious as being a million times smarter than you. How so?
Well, I think this is true for pretty much any artist or doing any creative work. You're usually trying to get out of your own way. I often go into a story, not necessarily knowing where it would lead. We might begin with like an impossible premise or a premise that just feels almost impossible to resolve. And then we go and see where it leads, I guess. I kind of let maybe the story lead the way. The characters tell me what's happening. And I feel that's the case for most things that I write, but definitely for the stories in Bliss Montage, I entered each story pretty blindly.
Mm-hmm. The opening story in Bliss Montage is called Los Angeles, and it's about a woman who lives in a mansion with 100 of her ex-boyfriends. Can you tell us about this story?
Yeah, I think the initial premise came from a dream, probably, and it was about, in the dream, I was married to a very wealthy man. And so I thought, great, now I can get all my ex-boyfriends to come. And they were all artists or do all sort of creative types. And I thought they can just come live at the mansion. And this is like the greatest artist residency ever. And I think it was something about guys I had dated and how nobody was ever really able to make things work in terms of just holding down a job and being able to pursue their creative projects fully. I thought, wow, this is a great way out. This is a solution for us all. The story turned out to be a little bit different than the dream. I didn't know that the story would also grapple with one of the main characters' exes who was abusive to her, and it's about domestic violence. So I kind of springboarded into the story on this sort of thinking about wish fulfillment and thinking about subverting capitalism. And maybe this idea also of being so protected by wealth that you're maybe protected by from your own feelings or from your own past in some way. And it doesn't work. I think the past catches up to her.
Yeah, very well said. Is this unusual or is this a usual process for you to base your stories on dreams like you did with Los Angeles, or is that kind of rare?
I don't know. I think some of the stories in Bliss Montage, well, quite a few actually, are at least with the initial premise, I started off thinking about a dream. Usually, if a dream sticks with me, there's some kind of anxiety source that is still pretty potent to me. So we kind of try and figure out what the anxiety is. I mean, anxiety is a great inspiration source for writing fiction.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Back in the day, you interviewed authors for indie magazines that were published in Chicago. And one of the authors you interviewed is Karen Russell, one of our favorite authors and a mm-hmm. former guest on our show, Beta. Did that conversation with Karen have an impact on your writing?
I don't exactly remember what she said specifically that sort of made me realize that I could work in a more surreal framework, in a more sort of fantastical framework. I think she had just released her first collection of short stories, which I absolutely loved reading, and they were kind of surreal and fantastical. I think it was more maybe in speaking with her, the freedom that she felt in starting with these more wild and fantastical premise that made me realize I could maybe go the same route. Also, when I was speaking to her, it was over the phone, and I just remember in the middle of the conversation, a squirrel came into our home through the porch. So I just remember trying to get the squirrel out of our living room at the same time while speaking to her. It was a very strange conversation, but she was very fun to speak with.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and that first book, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, that first short story collection is great. Yeah. I can see why it would have kind of an impact on you. You worked as a fact checker at Playboy magazine, and you also wrote girl copy for the magazine. What is girl copy?
Oh, well, it's mostly the text that accompanies sort of like the pictorials of the girls, and that was called girl copy. Most of my job entailed fact checking, so but occasionally I wrote for the magazine, and I did some editing as well.
Did you write any of the stories that are in Bliss Montage while you were working at Playboy?
I think the two oldest stories in the collection, which I wrote before Severance or concurrent with Severance, is Yeti Lovemaking and Los Angeles. I think it was mostly Yeti Lovemaking that I do remember writing that when I was working at the Playboy office. And really, it was kind of inspired by working there. Playboy projected this sort of archetype of like masculinity, and we would have these, I remember looking at these fashion spreads, you know, like if you want to look like Steve McQueen, you know, you buy this pair of parasol sunglasses, or if you want to emulate Cary Grant, you should buy this pair of wingtips or something like that. And I was thinking about these archetypes of masculinity, but I thought, what if you push that even further to the extreme? Like, what does hysterical masculinity look like? And so I started thinking about Yetis and Sasquatch. And I just think like the ultimate form of masculinity is a self-enclosed, completely autonomous being who doesn't need anyone, who's very capable and strong and needs absolutely nothing from anyone else. So this idea of this Yeti, I guess, trying to domesticate himself in the story, Yeti Lovemaking, I guess, due to overpopulation, the Yetis have to kind of integrate into our society. And this idea of this Yeti trying to domesticate himself, that was a starting point for it. And then, of course, our main character has sex with the Yeti. So there you go.
Exactly. Indeed. It's a great story. As all the stories in your book are. Well, one of my favorite stories in Bliss Montage is Office Hours. Can you tell us a bit about this one?
Well, yeah. So in Office Hours, it follows this professor of film studies, and she is where she always wanted to end up in life, which is to be on a tenure track, but she's not satisfied. And she takes over the office of her former mentor, who's now retired, and she discovers there's a portal in the closet of the office. And I think I'll just leave it at that before I give away the story.
The one thing that really struck me in that story was at one point, the protagonist, Marie, remembers something that her professor, the mentor, said in a lecture, quote, "It is in the most surreal situations that a person feels the most present, the closest to reality," end quote.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that line. Is that something that applies to you?
I think often in the most extreme situations, I think it jolts us out of maybe our everyday complacency, our everyday lull, and extreme situations, including catastrophes. Or maybe it doesn't, you know, in some way. In Severance, it doesn't seem to jolt Candace Chen out of her work lull. But it's interesting you mentioned that, because I just read this wonderful poem the other day. It's called Catastrophe is Next to Godliness. It's a poem by Franny Choi. And if you don't mind, there's like two lines I'd like to read from the end of
it. Yeah, please.
So in the last stanza, I'll just read it. It says, "Lord, if I say, bless the cold water you throw on my face, does that make me a costume party? Am I greedy for comfort if I ask you not to kill my friends? If I beg you to press your heel against my throat, not enough to ruin me, but just so I can almost see your face. And the way that the poem starts is, Lord, I confess I want the clarity of catastrophe, but not the catastrophe.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. And yeah, that very much applies to this sentence we were talking about. Your novel Severance came out in 2018, and the storyline about the Shen fever pandemic sweeping across the world seemed to predict the COVID-19 pandemic. What was going through your mind when COVID struck and you realized, hey, I covered this like 2 years ago in my novel?
Well, at first I think I was a little bit skeptical, like, oh, of course we all want to, you know, find answers in fiction. But as I think we went into lockdown and we would, you know, started buying masks, and people started tweeting about still having to go to work, I realized that the novel resonates, I think, in our collective frustrations about work and in this kind of shock that maybe that like capitalism still keeps going despite this global sort of catastrophe, and that sense of the surreal, I could really feel how Severance resonated during that time. But at the same time, I did receive some interview requests, but I wasn't interested in analyzing or promoting the book. Yeah, it was the last thing I really wanted to do. And I think at that time, I spent a lot of time in solitude. I became a little bit more isolated. And that's when I was writing Bliss Montage.
Mm-hmm. And you don't want to, and we don't want to get too caught up on the resemblance between the Shen fever and the pandemic, because Severance, your novel, is about a lot more than that.
Yeah, you know, I started writing it, I think I wrote it between 2012 to 2016. And in 2016, when Trump was elected, I thought, oh, my novel is very quaint or somewhat outdated. Because if Severance in some way was supposed to reflect like the absurdity of this era of work life, of capitalism, what it felt like when Trump was elected was that there was a new era of absurdity that was ushered in, and things that would have been read before as satire would have now read as realism. Our relationship to absurdity really changed, I think. So by the time Severance was published in 2018, I was feeling like, oh, maybe this book is a little bit outdated or something.
Right, exactly. I wonder if some of your short stories are going to come true in the next few years. Do you think making love with Yetis and sharing houses with 100 ex-boyfriends could become the next big trends?
I really have no idea. You know, I guess because of Severance, I become posited as a seer or something.
Yes,
it's so strange because I just feel mostly blind when I'm writing fiction. I feel like I'm going into these projects pretty blindly. So It's flattering they think of me as a seer, but, you know, who knows?
If you don't mind my asking, what are you working on now?
I'm working on another project. I think it's another fiction project. Before I wrote Severance, I had abandoned a novel, and what I'm seeing in this new project I'm working on, I seem to be maybe rewriting parts of this old novel. So I'm wondering if I'm trying to take another attempt at it or not. The characters are all new, and the circumstance is also new, but the questions are the same, and there's an element in it that's also very similar to the abandoned novel. So I think I'm trying to work out some questions that I abandoned before.
Good. Ling Ma, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Bliss Montage and on Severance. I'm looking forward to reading your next book.
Thank you so much. It was great to speak with you.
Ling Ma is the author of the short story collection, Bliss Montage. You can find out more about Ling and her fiction at wpr.org/beta.
Black Flag was a really interesting band in that their sound was too hardcore for the established LA Hollywood punk scene.
Coming up, music journalist Jim Ruland shares the story of how SST Records went from indie giant to nearly non-existent. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. In 1966, a 12-year-old named Greg Ginn launched an electronics company in Southern California called Solid State Tuners. Greg then reinvented the company as a record label called SST. This allowed him to release music by his band, Black Flag. SST went on to release music by other influential bands like Husker Du, The Minutemen, and The Meat Puppets. The indie label was also at the forefront of the alternative music scene, releasing records by Sonic Youth and Dinosaur Jr. But by the 1990s, it all began to unravel. Music journalist Jim Ruland is the author of Corporate Rock Sucks, The Rise and Fall of SST Records. Our resident musicologist Steve Gotcher sat down with Jim to find out more.
It's really the story of how Greg Ginn and his associates started up the label with out of basically nothing, and it grew into this basically this unstoppable force of indie music. You know, became the coolest, most sought after, most respected indie label in America. But as time went on, its practices became more and more corporate.
So what were the circumstances that made it possible for SST to exist?
I think that Greg Ginn's experience as a business owner prior to starting the record label was really invaluable. As a teenager, he'd started up this company called Solid State Tuners. From there, that gave him a lot of the tools and resources for the record label. When SST morphed into a record label, he really hit the ground running.
So he had business acumen, but what were the things in the world that sort of made it a perfect storm for SST to resonate with people?
Well, I think what was really interesting about, you know, punk rock and alternative music and indie music is that it was very regional. And as the technology grew and people had access to music outside of their regions that wasn't just the radio, for example, college radio stations starting up, playing alternative music, playing songs that you wouldn't be able to hear on the airwaves was a huge factor in SST's growth. And also the emergence of video and MTV played a role as well in expanding its audience to people who might not hear this music.
How significant do you think SST's role was in the growth of punk music?
SST's role in establishing the touring circuit and the foundation that so many other bands followed really cannot be overstated. Black Flag went out and went to places in the United States and Canada that nobody else had ever been to, except maybe bands like DOA out of Vancouver. And they were relentless about it, and their touring operation got bigger and bigger and longer. They drove more miles and they went to more places, and they weren't playing at established clubs either. They had built up this network of like-minded people who were renting out VFW halls or doing things in restaurants that didn't even have, you know, live music nights. It was very much a grassroots thing. And from there it expanded and many people followed. Black Flag took other bands on the label with them. And from there it just grew.
Who are some of the bands that helped establish SST as a viable record label?
Well, I think some of the local bands that SST started out with that became very popular outside of the region definitely played a role. For example, the Minutemen, who some regarded as like the, you know, the kings of college radio, and were really starting to develop a following, and in fact were touring with REM in the weeks before guitarist and vocalist Dee Boone died. Let's see, I got a number. Husker Du were huge, and the way they toured and traveled the country was extremely influential and was exactly what SST was looking for in artists. People that were prolific and not afraid to change their style and would tour relentlessly. Sonic Youth, for sure. Sonic Youth had already put out other records with independent labels, most notably Homestead. And by the time that they had signed with SST, had already toured Europe 4 or 5 times. So they were road dogs. They were very experienced. They had low expectations for, you know, what a tour could do for them, and were really about creating new music and putting in the work, and they really refined those songs on the road. Some bands, they test the music out on the road and then they go into the studio to perfect it. And Sonic Youth was the other way around. So by the end of a tour, a Sonic Youth song might sound very different than the way it did on the record.
So the band that actually put SST on the map and sort of was the impetus to start the label was Black Flag. Tell me about that band.
Black Flag was a really interesting band in that their sound was too hardcore for the established LA Hollywood punk scene. And that was really the impetus for SST, is that Greg Ginn said, fine, I'll do it myself and I'll keep the scene here in the South Bay, here in the beaches. And so the early bands that SST championed, you know, came from San Pedro and Torrance and Redondo Beach and things of that nature. Black Flag, you know, they had this amazing sound. And I think the thing that is most consistent about Black Flag is the intensity. You can hear the intensity in the songs, you can hear it on the records, and you could absolutely feel it when they perform live. Dallas, Coward, ride the cold, rise above, we're gonna rise above,
make this score what we say, rise above, we're gonna rise above. We talked about SST being a kind of a punk music label, at least to begin with, but one of the bands that broke that mold right away was the Meat Puppets.
Meat Puppets is a really interesting band because people didn't really know what to do with them. They didn't fit into any categories that were very easily identifiable. They sounded hardcore, but weren't. That first record sounded like a lot of noise, and it wasn't until they listened over and over again they realized that these were some brilliant musicians who were very much in control of what they were doing. Let me see everything.
Greg Ginn's brother Raymond Pettibone played a major role at SST. What was his role there?
Raymond Pettibone is an incredible artist and today a highly regarded and much sought after fine artist. But back then he was known as the Black Flag artist because his work was used on so many flyers and album covers. And there's something about Pettibone's vision. And it was a little bit retrograde in the way that it featured all these countercultural figures from the 60s, the late 60s and early 70s, all these Mansonoid figures, you know, they were with knives and semi-naked and, you know, just disturbing scenes with police officers and animals that was just shy of being grotesque. it didn't really matter where you saw these, whether it was on a flyer or on a poster or an album. It was arresting and it caught your attention. And Black Flag was the perfect soundtrack for those disturbing visions. What was interesting about Pettibone is that he never sat down and made a cover. He would not draw something to be used for a Black Flag record or a flyer. Rather, he was extremely prolific, and the people at SST would come to him and comb through his drawings and say, okay, we'll use this for a flyer or we'll use this for an album cover. The visions that he created were independent of the music.
Yeah, that is pretty amazing. Greg Ginn's concept of punk was that it wasn't a particular style of music, but, quote, it was an environment where people that made any kind of music that was outcast from the formulaic rock of the time had a venue to play. How did that idea clash with popular concepts of punk?
Well, I think once punk became popular, people had a notion of what it should be. I think that the early 70s scene is a great example of Greg Ginn's vision of what punk was. I mean, look at the Screamers, for example, a band that didn't even have guitars compared to Germs, musicians that barely knew how to play their instruments. You know, to the Weirdos, you know, people who are very accomplished with their instruments, but put on an incredible show with really flashy outfits and intense energy. I mean, they're all very different bands, but I mean, you can't tell the story of LA punk without them, and those bands sound nothing alike.
For some of the bands that signed to SST, the label became a stepping stone to get to major labels. Who were some of those bands, and how was SST helpful in getting them to that next level?
I think the most obvious case is Soundgarden, perhaps the most well-known outside of indie circles of all the bands that had been on SST. Soundgarden attracted interest from major labels, but the band very shrewdly recognized that they weren't ready, that they didn't have quite the following that other bands that were making the leap from the indies to the majors had. So they wanted to get to tour and put out a record with SST and get some experience on the road and build up a following before they made the jump to the major labels.
Now, SST hasn't released any new music since 2014, and there hasn't been a lot going on at the label in the last few years. What are some of the things that have contributed to the decline?
Some of the things that contributed to SST not releasing as much music was, distributors going under and, taking a lot of cash flow out of the loop. And then there was lawsuits involved with artists who maintained that SST had not paid them the royalties that they were owed. And these resulted in very public fights that really eroded the cachet that SST had built up all through the 80s. So that when the 90s came along, when you would think SST would be poised to take that next big step, along with so many other labels, Nirvana happened. And we all know that story.
So ultimately, what do you think the history books are going to say about how SST contributed to popular music?
Well, the sheer volume of incredible music that SST released is going to be its legacy. No other independent label became as big or had such a diverse roster of artists to create such a meaningful impact on the musical landscape. Unfortunately, that legacy is going to be tarnished by the label's business practices and the fact that so many of its artists left the label or sued to get the rights to its music back.
Well, Jim Rulin, thanks a lot for joining us today, and thanks for your book, Corporate Rock Sucks. It's a great contribution to the history of popular music.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Jim Ruland is the author of Corporate Rock Sucks, The Rise and Fall of SST Records. He talked with Steve Gotcher. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Penn Jillette, Ling Ma, and Jim Ruland. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Don't forget to offer a rating or to share with new alphas. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I also never saw him show any enjoyment or understanding of music.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
If you had someone who was actually a business person on that show, it would be the worst show in the world.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Beta Country, let's ride! More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
If you have thrown off some filters, I'll listen to you talk.